Blog Talk Radio.
And once again, Chuck Williams with you from the International Association of Black Triathletes, getting ready to talk with Mr. Anthony Reed this evening. Getting ready to talk to him about all the good things that he's able to do and how he's managed to make his passion, turn his passion into a business, and just get ready to do it all over again. And just waiting for Mr. Reed. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Mr. Reed, glad to talk to you this evening. I tell you what, I was just looking at looking over some of your credential, if you will, and seems like just recently you've been interviewed for Runner's World magazine article concerning racing and over racing. You also have an article about T. Morgan, one of the people that has did the Seven Continents Marathon finisher. And that's scheduled for April, for the April edition of Black Sports, the magazine. And it also seems like you have an upcoming engagement in April in Detroit, Motown. And it's something of a seminar, I guess, showing how managing changing conditions of racing relate to technological changes in business and the workforce. You see, just at the outset, it seems like you have a pretty busy schedule ahead of you. What do you think?
Yes. As I said, an idle mind is a devil's workshop. So the more things I have on my plate, the more I stay out of trouble.
Right. Yeah, can't get into trouble that way, that's for sure. You know, just out of, you know, for my curiosity, how did you get started in triathloning?
Well, when I was about 8 years old, I was diagnosed with a pre-diabetic condition, and the doctor said I would go on insulin by the time I was a teenager. I went to a high school where it was mandatory that you participate in a sport 2 out of the 3 seasons. So I ended up getting involved in sports and lost weight and didn't have to go on insulin in high school. In college, I read the book Aerobics by Dr. Kenneth Cooper. And in the book, he had one paragraph where he said that individuals who maintain a physical fitness program could either, and ones who are diabetic, could either decrease their insulin intake or go completely off of it if they maintain a fitness program. So with that in mind, I decided to focus on putting together a lifetime fitness program.
Right. It seems like that lifetime fitness program, let's just say, is a little bit less wear and tear and economically as well as physically than buying the insulin and having to inject yourself, guarantee you. And it seems like you made the right choice all the way around. You know, you're one of the few people, you've completed over 100 marathons, including running on all 7 continents. Now, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. If somebody held a gun to my head right now and told me to name the 7 continents, I couldn't name them. Here you ran on all 7 continents. Man, give me the impetus behind that.
Well, when I started off running and working out, as I like to say, I was economically challenged, as I was the sole support for a family of 4. So my thing was, I said, well, if I could just stay healthy enough until my kids got out the house, I could then be able to travel the world. So I set this unusual goal of running 50 marathons in one state, which was Texas. So for the first
15 years, I was literally just running marathons in Texas. So then after I completed that goal, I had a business trip in Europe, and actually I took advantage of being overseas and ran a marathon in Europe. And then I always wanted to run a marathon on my 50th birthday, and there were only two marathons in the world that would land on my 50th birthday, and that was the Leadville Marathon in Colorado or the Gold Coast Marathon in Australia.
Okay.
So with that, I ended up going down to Australia, and I had been debating about whether or not I wanted to run marathons on all seven continents. After the Australia Marathon, we went on a tour of a rainforest, and the first thing we did was we walked up to a tree, and a guy goes, "This is the Antarctica tree." While I had the application for the Antarctica Marathon in my pocket. So I just kind of took that as a sign that I needed to go ahead and knock out the seven continents. So I ended up doing it. But I have to admit, one of my early motivators was my brother, Curtis,
right,
who's a year older than I am. And in the summer of 1978, he was supposed to go on a bicycle trip that went from St. Louis, Missouri to Vancouver, Canada. I think it was,
wow,
people were trying to go up to Alaska. But he ended up, he got tied up in doing something, wasn't able to leave with everyone else, so he decided to do the trip by himself. And so he rode from St. Louis up to Vancouver, Canada, which is about a 1,300 to 1,400-mile bike ride. And it was like, you know, you can do anything you want to if you just put your mind to it.
Right.
And then later on, he lived over in Africa for about 18 years. Learned to speak French, Portuguese, Arabic, and Swahili all fluently.
Wow.
So from my perspective, from looking at my older brother, it's like, you know, the only limits you have are the ones you place on yourself, both mentally and physically.
Right.
And so since we kind of lived in the projects and lived in the St. Louis Center City, it was somewhat unusual, I guess you might say, for us to want to do those types of things, but we didn't let the limitations that other people would want to place on us get in the way of us achieving our goals.
That is, it seems like you carry forth with the mindset that if you can think it, you can do it.
Yes. Yes, very much so. And for me to have an understanding of black history and even just family history alone is a thing that motivates me to overcome a lot of obstacles. We had an uncle who was one of the first professional black motorcycle racers in the Ohio Valley region. So I can remember walking into his place and seeing trophies that were like as tall as I was. And so it, you know, kind of became like, okay, well, I guess, you know, my family, we have this kind of, we're thrill seekers almost.
Right.
And so getting involved in sports was one way of satisfying that, which is actually called the type T personality, which is for thrill seekers.
Oh, okay.
That's something...
I know about the type A.
Okay, yeah, there's also a type T personality. And that's something that got started in part as a result of the X Games.
Okay.
One of the questions they were asking was, you know, well, what type of person would get on a motorcycle and do flips or do all the different things they've been doing on snowboards? And so they started studying that, and the type T personality is one that's based on thrill-seeking. So you have some people who enjoy thrill-seeking and others, of course, who try to avoid it like the plague. But the interesting thing is there are not only physical thrill-seekers, there are also mental thrill-seekers.
Right.
And those are people who enjoy intellectual challenges, be it everything from working crossword puzzles to even becoming entrepreneurs. So... We both happen to be both mental and physical type T type T personalities. And in fact, it's one of the things I ended up writing about in the last book that I have called Running to Leadership, What Finishing 100-Plus Marathons on All Seven Continents Teaches Us About Success.
And that's exactly where I want to go next. The relationship, your relationship between triathloning and the business world, that those two entities in themselves are very closely related, although it really doesn't seem so, but in you're maintaining that there's a very, very close relationship, correct?
Yes. Yes, in fact, Running Times magazine wrote an article about it. Runner's World also wrote an article about it. And it's all about, again, taking risk. It's about moving outside of your comfort zone, putting yourself out there for risk of failure. And the interesting thing is that everyone fails. It's just a question of how you go about handling it, how you go about recovering from it. Some people
right.
fall down and they stay down, and it's other people that pick themselves up. So I actually found myself using all of the skills and the mental techniques associated with sports, with using those with managing project teams. And
okay.
I've gotten some truly amazing results doing it. We completed one $12 million international project for only $2.6 million. We did a 27-month project in only 9 months. And I had been doing this for years with members of my staff, but it was all somewhat subconscious. One day I was having lunch with a gentleman that used to work for me, and he made the statement, he goes, you know, Tony, I'm doing the exact same thing I was doing on the job while you were there, but it's just not fun anymore. And he ended up leaving the company. And I had explained to him the different techniques and things I was doing, and he said, well, you know what, it really did work. So for me, I would end up challenging my staff members, getting them to understand the concepts of having, you know, mantras to keep you moving through those tough times, of having what I like to call my motivational songs. I always like to say have a mantra in your mind and a song in your heart.
Right.
Just to keep you moving. And then to overcome the fears that we have of failure. So one of the things I always told my staff, I said, you know, all of you are professional. I didn't hire you to be idiots. I hired you because you are an intelligent person. And if you're smart enough to identify a problem, you're smart enough to come up with three possible solutions to that problem. And when you think about it, as athletes, we do the exact same thing. If we have an injury or we're faced with a problem, we turn around and we start doing research on how to go about solving it. We seek
right.
out other people. We get medical help. But we just don't sit there and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything about this, and we quit. So I got them to start thinking more about solutions to problems rather than just having the problem. And the more solutions they could come up with, the lower the anxiety level would become. And it's the exact same thing with athletes. So there's a really strong correlation between what we do in triathlons and duathlons and marathons is to what we end up doing in the business world.
Do me a favor. Tell me this. Just out of the blue, how do you take a passion? And apparently, well, obviously your passion is triathloning. How do you convert that into a business that you can support yourself?
Well, fortunately, I guess I'm a CPA.
Okay.
But at the same time, I spent 30 years working for companies as an IT executive.
Okay.
And one of the things I always tell people is anything that you have a passion about, someone has made $1 million doing it. Be it, you know, selling products, providing services. Someone has gotten rich off of virtually anything you can come up with.
Right.
And so it's a matter of developing a business plan and being very honest with yourself about the business plan. And, again, being just like an athlete, there are things that you turn around and you try, and, you know, if it doesn't work, you go back to the drawing board, but you basically just kind of don't give up. So one of the things that I tell people, again, just laying out a business plan, is it's important that you identify your target audience. It's also important that you identify the differences between your customer and your consumer. And that is to say, the customer is the person to whom you sell your product. The consumer is the person who uses your product.
Right.
Unfortunately, a lot of people will try to sell their product to a consumer who may or may not pay for it instead of to the customer who actually does pay for it.
I kind of see your point on that.
So a good example might be student calculators. When I worked at Texas Instruments, I worked there back in the early 80s, and then I went back there back around the 2006 or something like that. And I asked them, I said, why are you still selling calculators? Because they spun off their consumer products division. And the person told me that, surprisingly, they don't sell calculators to high school students and college students. And I said, really? And they said, yeah, what we do is we sell calculators to the educational testing services and to the textbook publishers. If we can convince them to use our calculators, then they will turn around, and it's almost like they'll force the students to have to go out to purchase those particular items.
Right.
So they did not market and sell their calculators to the students. The students are the consumers. They would market and sell their calculators to the textbook publishers and the testing organizations. Those are their actual customers. So
okay.
When you look at, for example, putting together a business plan, and again, that's one of the things that I had to do for my business as a professional speaker and writer, was I had to ask myself, okay, who are the consumers versus who are my customers? And you start looking at things from a purely business perspective. Being a professional speaker is almost as difficult, I guess you might say, as being a professional musician. I could even say it's almost as difficult as being a CPA.
Right.
Every tax season, if you drive through neighborhoods, you'll see people with signs up on the post saying they'll do your taxes for $15 or they'll do your taxes for $10.
It sounds like my tax man, to tell you the truth.
And people would look at a CPA and they would go, well, you know, why should I pay you this much money when I can go to this other person and pay 10 or 15 bucks to get my taxes done? So you have to be able to articulate the value that you bring to the situation that the $15 tax preparer does not bring. And so as a professional speaker, I have to be able to address why someone should pay me money to fly me out of town, take care of my hotel, and have me speak for an hour when they have someone, let's say, in their organization who's willing to speak for free.
Okay.
So I have to be able to articulate why they should bring me in instead of someone else, instead of a free speaker.
Basically, you're telling me you have to, first off, you have to be able to sell yourself.
Correct.
Like in triathloning, you have to, literally, you have to sell yourself to yourself so you can go out there and do the darn thing in the first place. But in the business world, while you have that confidence already, now you have to go out and you have to convince somebody else to think like you are.
Right. Yes. And just like in triathlons, you know, you have your competition. And you have to be able to know that you are just as good, if not better, than your competition, despite what your competition may be saying about you.
Right.
I can remember being in a biathlon. It was a 13-mile bike race followed by a 3-mile run. And the bike leg was first, which was really unusual. So drafting was allowed. And I can remember sitting there at the starting line, and these guys are kind of looking over at me, and I'm the only black in the race. And I can tell what was going through their minds is, oh, we're going to drop this guy. You know, and I knew that that's what they were thinking.
Right.
But I ended up being one of the first off the bikes. And literally the only reason I did not win that race was because a gentleman who was supposed to be directing the runners saw me running and didn't tell me to turn. And so instead of getting first overall, I ended up getting first in my age group.
Okay.
Because I literally ran about 100 yards too far, had to turn around and double back.
That would make that I can see, Ren, that would get you a little upset.
Yes. So, but again, you know, a lesson that I learned from that is if you're going to be taking a lead, you need to know where you're going. You can't depend on other people.
Right, right. One of the many things that, and I guess this is something that has been handed down over the years. As far as endurance sports, if you go medically, there are some medical professionals that would say that African Americans are not built for endurance sports. They're not really that good at endurance sports. And as an aside, normally when I hear somebody say that or if I think about it, I often think to myself, how many times has this doctor ever been out to a triathlon to see that maybe one or two of us are out there and we do very well. But from a historical perspective of African Americans in endurance sports, and do you see this population and the numbers growing larger than perhaps at any other time?
Yes, I do. I see that we are the third boom, so to speak, in endurance sports. The first boom was getting the average Caucasian man off the couch and getting him interested in running and working out. The second boom came in the 1990s, and that
right.
is when women really started getting involved in it. African Americans and other minorities represent a very, very small percentage right now, and we certainly aren't representative of the percentages that are in the endurance sports. And I think that due to exposure, due to, for example, our children seeing us getting out there doing these things, that we're planting the seeds for us to be the next major boom in endurance sports. So I can remember getting out there, and I was the only black in a lot of races in the early days.
Right.
However, the more I started seeing other blacks and the more other blacks started seeing me, the more they began to believe that this is indeed something that they can actually do. Sometimes I think we are our own worst enemies when we tell other blacks. Well, when we turn around and there's a conversation, for example, about doing triathlons, and, you know, you may go to your family reunion and say, hey, you know, I did a triathlon, and people turn and look at you like, you know, like you're crazy. So, and other people will kind of hear that, and they'll kind of think, well, you know, maybe I won't try that because I see, you know, what other people are telling, you know, him or her. So sometimes we can be our own worst enemy. And so what I try to do is try to basically surround myself with like-minded people,
right.
You know, so that we all support and help each other. I also try to, through the National Black Marathoners Association, promote and talk about the accomplishments of other endurance athletes, because I believe the more you find out what other people are doing, the more you realize that, you know, your ideal of being healthy or your ideal of completing a goal is something that, oh, this is realistic, you know, this can be done. The goals that I set for myself were partly based on talking to other people who have already achieved those goals.
Right.
So support groups such as the International Association of Black Triathletes, to me, can definitely fill that role. When people see, it's one thing for people to see one black participating in a sport. It's another
right.
thing for them to look up and see 4, 5, 10, or 15, or 20 all at the same event participating. It's sort of a very powerful message to anyone else who may be watching that particular event.
Excuse me for cutting across right here. Am I also hearing something I believed in, and it's kind of, I'm hoping I'm on the right track. Am I also hearing that triathlon as well as in business, another correlation, am I also hearing that success can become a habit?
Yes, you are hearing that success can become a habit. And again, looking at the people who are highly successful with people who failed and overcame those failures, I think when people start triathlon, and chances are great, they may be good in one of the three sports. And so they have to clearly move outside of their comfort zone in order to become accomplished in the other two. So, I mean, I've met people that never swam a day in their life and decided, you know, well, you know, hey, I've been running or I've been cycling. I think I want to do this triathlon thing.
Right.
And so they have to mentally, literally they have to mentally overcome that fear of swimming in order to complete the triathlon. And you get the same thing in the business world. For example, very few of us took college classes in sales, you know, how to go about selling something.
Right.
However, if you want to run your own small business, you can be the best engineer in the world, but if you don't know how to sell your services, you're not going to get anywhere. You're going to be a good engineer, but you're going to be starving.
That's true. That is true.
So with triathloning, since you have to move outside of your comfort zone in order to learn this new sport, that same openness to learning new things applies to starting your own business. I had to learn how to sell. I mean, and this is something that I truly hated doing it, but I realized if I couldn't sell myself, I was going to starve.
Right.
And so
well,
you know, you get to be really good at it.
And it seemed like you had the impetus to be good at it. The difference between eating tonight and not eating tonight, you know. So that seems like that was a pretty good incentive to get that to learn the art of salesmanship, if you will.
Right, and you also learn how to plan. So, for example, I know that I can't walk up to a conference, the very day that they're about to have the conference and say, hey, I want you to pay me to be your keynote speaker. They would look at me and say, well, that was a decision we made 5 to 6 months ago.
Right.
And so it's like most people cannot walk up to a triathlon, you know, the day of the race and say, hey, I think I want to do this thing, and just dive right in. So in both situations, you have to sit back, you have to lay out a schedule, you have to, know how to follow up in order for you to be successful in that particular business. It's just not going to happen overnight. So you do have to plan ahead.
Excuse me for cutting across. Just in talking with you, you said you have that type T personality. Does that type T personality, well, type T way of personality, does that also have to have like a type T personality? In other words, the positivity to go along with it in order for it to be successful?
Yes, it does. Because, again, you are in a role of making mistakes and then learning from those mistakes, correcting them, and going straight back at it again. There is a book that I read called The Power of Personal Accountability, where he talked about any time a given situation happens, you have a choice of either being a victim or being accountable. When you go through being a victim, you're in a state of denial, you blame other people, and most importantly, you never change. It's always someone else's fault behind the failure. When you become accountable, you recognize as a problem, you own up to your particular part of that problem, you forgive yourself and others, you learn from those mistakes, and you take action. Some people are victims their entire lives. They're victims at work and they're victims at home. And most of us have relatives that we know who are victims. It's always someone else's fault. It's never their fault. So one of the things that we have to do as triathletes and athletes in general is we know how to go through that accountability loop. Training for something, and all of a sudden, you know, you realize that there's a problem. You have to correct it instead of just stopping right there and saying, I'm not going to fix the problem. That's the end of my training program. I'm not going to go through this race. So it's something that we subconsciously are always going through when training for endurance events. And it's just a question of us taking that same type of taking that same type of thing and applying it to things outside of work. I'm sorry, outside of training for triathlons and endurance events.
Right.
So you become flexible, and you become very creative, too, in solving problems.
Aha. There you go. Now I can literally really understand that something that goes back, I guess, to I remember many moons ago in school, that one of the first things when we got to junior high school, they were teaching us the 7 steps of problem solving, you know, identifying the problem, state it, you know, research, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know, as the executive director of the National Black Marathoners Association, how much are you really able to interject that positive type attitude? I mean, it has to be in the boardroom in order for it to travel down to the participants. How hard is that to do?
Well, fortunately, with the board members, it's really easy because I'm laughing at something. All the board members are type T personalities.
Right.
It's one of those things you don't realize you're around a bunch of type T personalities until you're around someone who's not a type T personality. Give you an example. I was in China for 2 weeks to run a marathon over there, and then just really hung around for 2 weeks with a bunch of other runners who were on a tour. When I came back to the U.S., I got depressed, and I couldn't figure out why. When sailing down to Antarctica a year later, there was a gentleman on a ship who was a self-confessed smoker and alcoholic. And one night he told me that he stopped smoking and drinking since he'd been on a ship with all of us. He said, because being on the ship with us was like being at a church revival, except instead of there being someone in front of you kind of whipping the audience up, you know, the preacher, everyone was so highly highly self-motivated.
Right.
The whole thing was completely contagious. And so when you get a bunch of type T's in a room, accomplishing anything is easy because they're not going to have a negative mentality of, you know, if you said you wanted to do something, they're going to give you excuses for why it can't happen. Instead, they're going to say, well, okay, let's take a look at this. Let's take a look at all the options. They're more into problem solving rather than running away from problems. Again, they're going to be more accountable than they are being having a victim mentality. And one of the things that we have noticed is, for example, at our very first event back in 2005, we only had 12 people to show up.
Okay.
And I was scared to death that they were going to cancel the race because they all knew we were meeting up there. And at our Hall of Fame event that we had in Richmond, we had about 420 to show up. So, and people were highly encouraged once they got there. People were just shocked that they were able to meet these individuals who had achieved some outstanding goals. And so they started looking up to them. Back in the 80s, for example, I had a poster on my wall of Nelson Vales. He was a black cyclist who was, I know he was, I'm trying to think if he had a world record in track cycling.
Okay.
But I had a poster of him on my wall. And he was, you know, the person that motivated me also in the cycling, in addition, of course, to my brother with the things that he was doing.
Right.
So I think the more we are around people who have achieved different goals, the more likely we are to go ahead and pursue those same or similar goals. So, for example, I think out of the first five or six blacks to run marathons on all seven continents, I happen to have met all of them.
Okay.
And
right.
More people meet us, the more they say, you know, hey, I think I want to pursue this particular goal also. Same thing with running marathons in all 50 states. Once I met people who had accomplished that goal, then I decided to go ahead and pursue it also.
Let me ask you
and
this,
I think,
if you might. Let me ask you
okay.
this, please. What is the common thread between all of the African Americans that have run on the seven continents? There has to be a common thread. Can you break that down?
I'm laughing because the first four of us who finished on all seven continents were born within about 3 days of each other. it was on different years, but they were all literally within about 3 days of each other.
Right.
And there's actually a theory behind that. I remember reading an article where they were saying the individuals who had the world record in the 100 meters, either the world record or the Olympic record, I think it was the Olympic record, I got the Olympic gold, all of them were born in the summer. And they reasoned that what happened is that babies that are born in the summer are more likely to go outside at an earlier age, and they actually get exposed to a lot more at an earlier age because it's nicer outside versus babies who are born in the winter time. You know, they're basically kept indoors for, you know, until the snow gets off the ground.
Right.
So, and so I always found it interesting. My birthday is July 2nd. And so as I started looking up the other runners who had finished on all seven continents, for a while it was like all of us were born in the summer. And by the way, with that study of the sprinters, there was one exception. There was a person who was born in the winter, but he was born in Australia, which was ironically their summer.
Their summer, right,
so,
right.
Yeah, so it still held up.
You know,
so, I think the one of the common threads is all of us are curious. You know, we see things and say it's one thing to see something on television. It's another thing to actually go out and experience it. And so we actually want to experience life.
Tell me this: what can I and a lot of our listeners, what can we expect to see from Anthony Reed coming up in 2015?
2015. Wow. Well, I would like to participate in a race with as many of my grandchildren as I possibly can. So I would like to get my family more involved in it. A lot of the members already are, but I would like to see all of us kind of get together and participate in a single event. So the Black Marathoners will be meeting here in Dallas for our annual summit and Hall of Fame banquet. So I would love to get as many people down here for that as possible. Like I said, in Richmond we had over 400. This year I would love to get between 500 to 600 runners down here. And it will be a beautiful sight at the starting line. We will definitely stand out.
Oh, that sounds like that would be that's a milestone in itself. That's a milestone in itself. You know, I would love to see. I do a lot of triathlons myself from the standpoint of the announcing side, and I see a lot of at the starting line. I can almost pick out and count on one hand and possibly have some fingers left over at this day and time. Now, the majority of the triathlons I do and announce are the sprint triathlons. I can still count the number of African Americans on one hand. And, you know, I'm just wondering what's it going to take to have a reasonable number, if there's such a thing, of representation on that starting line?
I think one thing it will take is exposure in the Black media. Endurance sports are one thing that they typically don't cover. However, I know that every time we have been in Ebony Magazine or other Black publications, we always get a spike and the number of individuals that join our group and in the number of individuals that express an interest in pursuing endurance sports. So I
right.
think if we can get the National Association of Black Journalists to start writing more articles and to start featuring us more, black youth will see that there is an alternative to playing football and basketball.
You know,
and more of them will consider pursuing the sport.
You know, just in that vein alone, let me ask, on that topic, do you think that a show like this that's put on by the International Association of Black Triathletes, do you think we're on to something with the radio show in helping to expose and to get people involved?
I definitely think that you're on the right track. Because it's important for us to record and track our history. And fortunately, with the blog radio, people can go back and they can listen to it. Teachers can reference it. We have seen situations in our case, for example, where one of the teachers, for example, was an endurance athlete, and lo and behold, her students decided that they wanted to pursue that also. And one of the things that she was looking for was basically resource materials and ways to show the students that, you know, that there are African Americans pursuing endurance sports. So I definitely think that what you're doing is indeed on the right track, and I sincerely hope that we continue it.
If we're looking in today's world, and every day we see what's going on, we're coming into a new sport. Well, at this point, it's not a new sport season. We're coming into a season where there's five or six sports going on at one time. How much do you think our major media, as and I'm saying like our major television networks and cable networks. Let's face it, now we have more, you see more triathloning in your major networks and on your cable networks today than you would have seen maybe, 10 years ago. What could be the incentive for them to get on this bandwagon? Or is there an incentive for them to get on that bandwagon?
Well, I believe that that is based on economics. If they see that there's a way that they can turn a profit off of it, then it's something that they will definitely pursue. One of the things that we like to bring up with people, potential sponsors, is you look at the fact that endurance athletes tend to have a higher level of discretionary income than non-endurance athletes. Also, within African Americans, endurance athletes are more likely to have undergraduate degrees as well as advanced degrees than the average African American. I have a higher level of income. We're more likely to travel. We are the best investment for sponsors, and that is endurance athletes. I think selling that to potential sponsors for these programs in order for them to be on television is what it's going to take for there to be even more. They need to recognize that this is an audience that loves to travel and will spend their money and they will invest it on themselves.
That is a very important, I can understand your issue on that. Once they see that they have, how shall we say, a monetary investment in this, and it's a piece of the pie, it seems like, then it becomes very interesting to everybody else. I do know that every now and then when they have the Big Island at Oahu, the Ironman, Spike TV, et cetera, they go out of their way to make sure that you capture something like this, and they run the whole thing. Of course, you know, they have to edit it, et cetera, to make it fit within the allotted time space, but still, 2 hours of that, that's a pretty good chunk of time out of the advertising into the advertising budget of most television stations. But, you know, I'm looking at it from this standpoint, too. Once you turn around and you get the word out, is there any way, you made mention of teachers, is there any way we can, let's face it, kids every day are cutting physical education classes, okay? Is there any way to possibly introduce some segments, which I feel it should be, some segments of triathlon into physical education classes at school, not just for the athlete, but for the regular kid who is not an athlete?
Oh, I think it's so critical. I can remember my brother telling me that there were, I think, 5 things every person should know how to do: drive a stick shift, how to swim, how to ride a bike, and how to speak a foreign language. I can't remember the 5th one. It's probably one I didn't know how to do. just looking at it as a race, a lot of us don't know how to swim. And
right.
To me, that is just so, it's something everyone should know how to do. You know, how to swim, and then perhaps if we stopped taking the public transportation so much and rode our bikes, with that we're getting into the city's infrastructures being built so that more people can ride bikes. And within the school system itself, I think, gosh, you need to stop slashing the budget for sports and kind of go back to the basics. I can remember in my junior high school, it was mandatory that everyone took swimming. And, you know, for PE, so we would all, you know, walk over to the place where there was a swimming pool, and they taught everybody how to swim.
Right.
And I don't know how many schools today still do that in the middle school. But I think that is that's just critical for adults to know how to do. And it saddens me when I see that, you know, a child died in a lake and the person who dove in after them did not know how to swim also.
Right, right. Anthony, just hold your point right there. By the way, I want to give a major shout out to Nun. The IABT, we're pleased to announce and to share that IABT has been named as an official sponsored organization from Nun. They're a sports hydration company, and each and every one of the IABT team members get a 30% discount off of Nun products for the 2015 tri season. Hey, make sure you give them a try. Hey, it's called Nun, N-U-U-N. Some great sports hydration products. You got to give them, you got to try this stuff. It is good. Anthony, back to you right now. You know, we're sitting up here talking about how we can expand ourselves in the sport of triathlon. You know, I'm looking at the sport of triathlon. It's really something that everybody can do. Everybody can do. Okay. Maybe you can't swim, but maybe you can bike. Maybe you're not that good a bike rider, but you can run. Triathlon also has a thing called relays, so I'm quite sure if you get somebody who can do what you can't and get another person who do what the other one can't, you got it made. It's really designed, the way I'm looking at it, it's really designed not necessarily for the superstar, but for the common man. Am I off base with this or what?
No, you're absolutely right. There's something in there for everyone. There is something there that plays to just about everyone's strength. To me, the big thing is getting people to step up to the plate and actually go ahead and pursue it. And one thing that is for certain is once they participate in one event, they want to keep coming back for more because they like the rush of endorphins. And it's addicting.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I noticed that I'm going around and I'm looking at a lot of triathlons and viewing a lot of the athletes, especially our African American athletes. There is always the economic quota that slips in there, whether you want it to or not, but still it slips in there. True, triathloning is not a poor man's sport. I'll grant you on that. But how can we get around? Let's face it. You're not going to go out here and get a Walmart Huffy and win the cycling leg of the Kona Ironman. You're not going to do it. How can you get around that?
Well, I think that your recommendation on kind of making it a relay kind of resolves that, because you can always find someone who is a cyclist. Because I'm seeing more and more black cyclists, for example, at White Rock Lake where I train.
Right.
And so I think it's just a matter of where you look to find those individuals. You can go, for example, to a master swim class. Most cities have a master swim group or a swimming group. And you could go there, for example, and say, okay, well, let's see how many blacks show up. So you can find someone there, you know, that you can work with. Or even if you have a HBCU that happens to have a swimming pool. Again, you can go there to find the person to do your swim leg. And, of course, running, you can just, you know, go to the track or go to your local running trail and just kind of see who seems to be there on a consistent basis. So I think to pull together a team for a relay is actually relatively easy. And so that way, again, you're not spending a lot of money. And, of course, the biggest investment, as I like to say, the biggest one-time investment may be the bicycle. But at the same time, in order to improve your swim, you may find yourself maybe paying more money over a long period of time to do that probably than the cost of a bike, or at least of a lower
right.
bike.
Well, let's face it, swimming trunks cost a little bit less than a cycle, you know, but no, you make a good point on that, an excellent point on that. What do you think of the first professional black triathlete, recognized in our era? And what does this mean, or better yet, what could it mean for future youth involvement and the face of overall African Americans at the starting line in triathlons?
I think it has a tremendous impact. The very first time I ran a marathon was the 1982 Cowtown Marathon, and it was won by a black guy that was born in Fort Worth, Texas. His name is Ricky Cox.
Okay.
And I actually thought it was normal for African Americans to win marathons, because he won it that year. He came back. He won it the second year. He ended up winning it three times. And then after him, there was another black that turned around and won a marathon three times. So for me, the impact of seeing this guy win the very first marathon I ran made me think this is normal for blacks to run. It's normal for us to participate in endurance sports.
Right.
So now that there is a professional black triathlete, I think other blacks now are going to start looking at him, because he's going to be a role model for all of them. They're going to be looking at him going, you know what, if he can do this, there's no reason in the world why I can't do it either. So, yeah, it's going to have a tremendous impact.
Well, the potential, the definite potential is there. I can definitely understand that. What race am I going to see you at? Better yet, before I get to that, I just want to ask you one thing. Give me your normal training day. Just a brief overview.
Wow. I was going to say, there isn't such a thing as a normal training day.
Okay, give me an abnormal training day. I don't care.
Wow. Well, one of the things that I try to do during the winter months is my longest run during the winter months is usually around between 15 to 18 miles.
Okay.
During the summer, that run is anywhere from 12 to 15 miles. And I like doing that because it always keeps me in shape for just about any endurance events.
Okay.
So that is, I guess, kind of the one common thing that I do. I have a lifetime goal of running 100 miles a month, or roughly 1,200 a year. And in January, I just finished my 40,000th mile.
Your what?
40,000th mile. So I've been keeping a journal since 1978. Sorry, since 1979.
Okay.
And I've averaged 3 miles a day, which is exactly the goal that I set for myself back in the early 70s, of averaging 3 miles a day of running. So that may mean running just 3 days a week, not running 3 miles every day, but I just always want to hit that average of 3 miles a day. And that's what has kept me off of running all these years.
I tell you what, you stopped me when you said 40,000th mile. I'm thinking, what? I can't even think back that far, man. You know, so more power to you.
It's on the same set of knees. Yeah, it's on the same set of knees I was born with.
Well, okay. Yeah. Thank goodness, no replacement parts are needed. Everybody, from what I understand, everybody has what is called a goal race. In other words, one that you just gotta get to, one that you got to do well in. If you do like maybe 3 or 4 triathlons this summer, maybe you do more, maybe you might do less. What is your goal triathlon this summer?
my gold triathlon this summer.
I mean, one that you know you got to do well on. This is the one you're shooting for.
Oh, it is one that they have over in Benbrook, over in the Benbrook area. And it's put on by, I think the group is called Ironside.
Okay.
I'm drawing a blank on the name of the race now. But yeah, that's...
But you do have one.
Yes. Yes.
Is there such a thing as getting ready and trying to peak for a race like that?
Oh, yes, most definitely. It's what I, one of the things is as I get closer to the race, of course, I start watching my diet a lot more than I usually do.
Right.
And I do more, tend to do more speed work the closer I get to it. So, I end up changing my diet and changing the types of training that I'm doing. Again, looking at the course, I may do more hills versus doing more flats. Again, doing more speed work.
Right.
So, yes.
Okay.
So,
I've often wondered. I mean, you know, a lot of people are probably thinking, here's a guy who's ran in triathlons on 7 continents. His training must go easy. His training must be really easy on him. If you have one, I got to know this. What's your sticking point? What's your toughest part of a triathlon?
My toughest part is the swim. And... I have a love-hate relationship with it. I love it because I'm floating. My joints aren't taking a pounding. Unfortunately, the bad thing about it is I can't talk to anyone else while I'm swimming.
Well, yeah.
Because I get a mouthful of water.
That will slow you down a little bit.
Yeah.
If you have one... And I'm quite sure you do. What is the legacy that you're hoping to leave for the future generation of endurance athletes, triathletes, marathoners, etc.? I would even go so far as to say even long distance track and field runners. What kind of legacy would you hope that that you're putting down now?
Well, I guess the legacy that I would like to leave is that you can do anything if you put your mind to it.
Okay.
Back in 1969, I happened to have been in Washington, D.C. a couple of days after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Right.
And what a lot of people didn't realize was that a lot of the federal buildings were closed to black tour groups. And I can remember standing there at the Capitol. We had our pass, and they refused to let us in. They told us to step aside and let white tour groups go in.
Right.
And so we ended up spending a lot of time at the U.S. Library of Congress and at the Smithsonian Institutes at their museums. So... I have been very fortunate and very blessed in that I became the first black in the world to run marathons on all 7 continents. And the Smithsonian Institute's Museum of African American History and Culture actually has my running clothes from the Kenyan Marathon, which was the 7th continent.
Oh, wow.
And my there's a group called the History Makers, which found out about my accomplishment, and they came and did about a 3.5 to 4 hour interview, video interview. And this was based off of the slave journals from the 1930s, in which they
right.
went around and there was a group that interviewed slaves. Well, this entire video collection of interviews from the History Makers was just accepted as a special collection in the U.S. Library of Congress. So,
okay.
Including my interview. So, it for me, it was real interesting when talking about legacies. As a kid, after going through that experience in Washington, D.C., I had a dream of, I said, it would be great to one day have something in the Smithsonian Institute and the U.S. Library of Congress.
Right.
And so here we are almost 40 years later. I'm having my life story, and my legacy is in the U.S. Library of Congress and Smithsonian Museum.
Man, I got anybody this famous, I have to get close to myself. I'm telling you that up front. That's impressive. From what I understand, you've been interviewed for Runner's World magazine, and with your article concerning racing and over-racing, and you also have an article about T. Morgan, another 7-continent marathon finisher, and that's going to be in Black Sports, the magazine. I think that's the April edition?
Yes. Thinking it's going to be in the April edition. So T ended up running half marathons on all 7 continents. She had previously run marathons on all 7 continents. So she's actually the first black in the world to do both of those.
And also, you got something coming up in Detroit on April 24th showing how managing changing conditions of racing relate to your technological changes in business and the workplace.
Right. I'll also be in Spokane, Washington, Colorado Springs, just a whole slew of places over the next few months.
Get your frequent flyer miles in order. No two ways about it. You have no idea, Anthony, how much I've enjoyed talking with you in this conversation tonight. And ladies and gentlemen, this IABT radio broadcast, it's the whole purpose is to educate and to increase participation of blacks in triathlons and add to the scholarly body, if you will, of knowledge and discussion on how to change the face of triathlons for African Americans. And Anthony Reed, I can tell just by talking with you, you are going out of your way. You're literally making the heavy inroads into the sport. And something a little bit more important, those heavy inroads into life. It's just making it better all the way around. Anthony, it was great having you. By the way, folks, tell you what, if you want to be a guest or a sponsor at your International Association of Black Triathletes Radio, why don't you email iabtriathletes@gmail.com. That's email of iabtriathletes@gmail.com. If you want to be a guest or a sponsor of the blog show, hey, give us a write down, shoot us an email, we'll see what we can do for you. Again, and also want to thank again our first corporate sponsor, IABT's first blog talk radio sponsor, Nunn Sports Hydration Company, for the 2015 triathlon season. Anthony, again, it was good talking with you. Folks, I'll be talking with you the next time. I'm Chuck Williams, and this is IABT Radio.